You know how we do on High Plains Morning. We like to have folks live in the studio to tell us about all their neat little things so we get to learn about them. Well, right now I've got Eric Meljack of the High Plains Poetry Project and WTAMU's Department of English, Philosophy, and Modern Language, as well as Jonathan Baker. He is a novelist, he is a writer, and he is one of our news punks here at High Plains Public Radio. Yes, and I'm so pleased you're both in here. This is exciting because, Jonathan, you're going to be doing a reading tomorrow night in Canyon, Texas, 7 p.m. at the Burrowing Owl Bookstore, one of my favorite places on earth.
Yeah.
And I've been everywhere on earth.
You have.
So
you have.
I have. So this is exciting. Eric, tell folks a little bit about the High Plains Poetry Project just so they know what the heck we're talking about first.
Oh, all right. So the High Plains Poetry Project is something that Dr. Pat Tyree and I started up a couple of years ago as a side project at the university to help promote writers. We started with just poetry, promoting poetry writers in the High Plains, trying to get readings and things sorted out. And we were so successful with that that we branched out and started bringing in fiction into the mix. So we kind of hold workshops, poetry circles, like next Thursday night at the same time and place, Burrowing Owl, we're going to have a poetry circle. All are welcome. Bring your favorite poems. Bring poems you wrote. You can read them there. We host those poetry circles. We host readings, a variety of things, but it's just to help promote writing in the High Plains.
Wonderful. I love it. And also, I mean, what is fiction except for poetry by someone who doesn't know how to rhyme?
That's so true.
Everything's a prose poem, right?
Yeah. I think so. Baker, tell folks a little bit about your story. You've got a really interesting story. You're from this region. You're from
it's
near
true.
Borger.
I'm from Canyon.
Oh, you're from Canyon.
No, my dad's from near Borger. He lived in Fritch for a lot of his life. And so I spent my summers in Fritch and Borger. And then, I went to school in Canyon. And tomorrow night I'm reading at, for years I was like, man, why don't we have a cool bookstore? On the square in Canyon. And then I heard that someone was going to open a bookstore. And I had that High Plains fear that we all have when you hear someone might do something and you're like, oh God, they're going to screw it up. And because we all know that. It's like with the baseball thing. It's like, please don't screw this up.
And it's honestly not just High Plains. I've had that my whole life and I'm from Kansas City. So
I feel like it's more potent here on High Plains.
I will not argue.
For various reasons.
As I've lived here longer and longer, I've learned to fear that the same way.
Yeah, you're just please, please let this be good. And Dallas Bell at the Burrowing Owl, I think we can all agree, has done a better job than anybody ever could have conceivably imagined. It's not just the best bookstore in the Texas Panhandle. It's one of my favorite bookstores in the entire universe. And I've worked at a lot of bookstores and I've been to a lot of bookstores and I love that bookstore. So yeah. I'm so grateful and really excited to be able to read at one of my favorite bookstores in my hometown.
You know, she's opening a second location at Summit Amarillo by the fall. So we're gonna start rotating readings between the two places and the poetry circle between the two places every other month or so. So
it's gonna be super successful. I can feel it in my bones. It's just like the perfect location. And I don't know, what a cool thing. Like, we deserve it. It's been a long time coming.
Well, she was shortlisted. Dallas Bell's Burrowing Owl Books was shortlisted for one of the best bookstores in the entire state of Texas by some Texas publication. So, I mean, she's getting recognition. And the store is getting recognition.
Good.
It's good.
It's well deserved.
Yeah.
The bookstore itself is just, it's pretty spectacular. It is chock full of books, very well curated, and it's just fun. There are new and used. The pricing is just perfect. And then these events where they cram in the back, and the readings that I've attended, you've got somebody standing in the back, people sitting around, standing around, just cram packed, and everyone is just riveted for a full hour. It's just so great to have a space to just shut up and listen to somebody.
Yeah. Yeah. Seth Wick read last month. And let me talk about for just a minute about some of the writers that we have here on the High Plains. Seth Wick read last week, and he teaches English over at and he teaches English over at Boys Ranch, but he had just returned from New York City where he had been meeting with agents. Just a staggering sort of talent, like a real sort of talent, but we have a lot of those kinds of writers. hiding in the woodwork out here. And when I came back from New York City, I decided, like, I'm going to go start shaking the tumbleweeds and see if any of these riders fall out, you know. And I've had the pleasure of meeting so many really, really good riders. Ryan McSwain and Mike Akins and Jenny Stalter. And these are all people that aren't, you know, that I consider friends now and that I meet with regularly, and we exchange pages. And so there's a real sort of community brewing here. And I think the Burrowing Owl and what the High Plains Poetry Project are working on, it's all sort of part of an organic multi-geared machine.
Yeah, it's kind of rhizomatic. Like we're all working independently, but we're crossing each other.
And, you English and, professors and, with your rhizomes.
Yeah, you know? Well, you know,
The WTAMU English. Go look it up, everybody. The rhizome is a great metaphor, but man, y'all be obsessed.
We all be obsessed with it. Yeah, you're right about that. But it really is. I mean, we're all doing similar things.
It's
and we're
true.
Crossing
no,
paths.
No, totally. And it's a good metaphor out here.
Yeah,
on the high
and
plains.
It's great. It's great that. There are so many of these, I call them smaller communities that are crossing over, and we're all finding each other. And
right.
it's really fun to do that because I discover new people every day, and you probably discover new people every day. And then we learn about them together. And
yeah.
it's a great set of projects that we're doing. You know?
And I should say, if you're out there somewhere in the Oklahoma Panhandle or in Southwest Kansas or Southeast Colorado, or even on that southern edge of Nebraska that we reach, if you're out there and you think, you know, I've always wanted to write, or you have been writing but just thought, you know, I'm never going to do anything with this, you should reconsider. You should come. We have a monthly group called the Story Brewers here in Amarillo. It's the last Monday of every month at the Long Wooden Spoon Brewery here in Amarillo. You can find us on Facebook. But come out, meet other writers, have a beer, or if you don't drink, have a Dr. Pepper like I do, and just talk writing, you know, and from there you can find a smaller weekly group that you can branch off into, and then from there you can all sort of decide, you know, let's see what we can publish in the next year, let's see what kind of a novel we can all produce if we show up here together and meet and exchange pages over the next week, you know, or over the next year, every week, you know. And if we start building these little groups, then we can start to create a movement here on the High Plains where real voices can be heard in the wider world. We have a shocking lack of published writers, given how many, I know the population may not seem huge, but it's big enough that we should be showing up more, you know, compared to other parts of the country, you know, because there's some real talent out here. But I think because of the wide open spaces, people feel like I can't get there from here. You know, the publishing world, New York City, that's all so far away. But I, you know, I'm from West Texas and I made it to New York City. I made it into the publishing world. And I can tell you that there are people in publishing in New York City. They don't care where the books are coming from. They just care that they're written with talent and with heart. And so if that's you and you're out there, let's get to work. You know, you can find the Story Brewers on Facebook.
Yeah. And if I can just add, I attended one or two of your Story Brewer sessions just to see what it was about. And man, is that a great community of people, just all supportive of one another, great feedback. It was a really interesting experience just sitting in on one or two of those and seeing what you're up to. Because I try to meet these different groups and try to see what's going on. And I thought Story Brewers was just a phenomenal there's a lot of people in it, but gathering of people just supporting one another and saying, let's publish.
Right.
And it, I mean, it's excellent. And yeah, you should make the travel in once or twice if you can to see what's going on, because you can get some good feedback and some positive reinforcement, which is nice, you know?
Yeah, it's about community. And the thing about writers is it's a very lonely, you know, existence. That's why I write in coffee shops, so at least I can feel like I have people sort of buzzing around me, even if I'm kind of in my own little world there. But
you're weaseling the juice off of their energy.
That's right. I'm weaseling the juice. And
there's plenty of caffeine, too.
So, I'm a juice weasel. But there are a lot of people who just write in their garage or in their other bedroom or, you know, whatever, and they don't talk to people. And being with other writers is so important, even if it's just once a month or, you know, once a week for an hour or whatever, just to say, because we get hung up. We get hung up on these problems, and that's why we have to read. You see, oh, I see how this author did that. But that's also why we have to go and meet with other writers, just to go, you know, I can't figure out what this, why my book stalled. You know, where is the forward progress? I feel like I'm flailing, and somebody else can say, I've had that problem, and this is what I did, you know, whether it's, you know, your character's motivation faltered here or whatever. But there are real rules, and there are real sort of tricks and tips that work, you know. So you don't have to be scribbling in the dark, you know, like, come out into the light. We're out here. We're waiting for you.
Scribbling, scrabbling, and scrambling.
Right.
Juice
weaseling.
I think it's very clear, just because, you know, this is a literary reading we're promoting for tomorrow night at the Burrowing Owl, and it's very clear from so far what we've discussed that you are also a literary mentor. You definitely try to encourage, you know, young writers on the High Plains, not just in these groups, but outside of that. Can you talk a little bit about what you've learned of being someone who has just really spent the most of what you spend your day on is focusing on creating fiction?
Right. So we talk a little bit more about which part, the mentoring or the creating fiction?
So to be able to be disciplined, to be able to focus, just the creation to get to that point. If you see a spark in a kid, how do you get them to become someone who can focus enough to get something quality out?
Okay, yeah. So a few things. The first thing is, your job is not to be a critic. Your job is just to write. That is so important. Literally every author, you know, Hemingway wrote about this, that, you know, his inner critic. We are all like that. You are not alone. So if you sit down to write and you think, oh, this is crap, no one's ever going to want to read this, you're wrong. Like, what you do is you move forward, you keep fixing, you keep growing, you keep learning. You know, you can always, it's so much easier to fix a broken house than it is to build a new one from the ground. So, you've got to learn to stifle that inner critic until you finish whatever the piece is. And then you can turn that critic back on and go, what does this need and how can I fix it? But getting to the end is so important. As far as writing novels go, the muse does not come around whenever you ask her to. Like, you've got to learn to sit
down. When you ask them to?
Right. You've got to learn to sit down and put your butt in the chair and write every day, whether the muse is around or not, whether you feel like writing or not. Because if you think that what, you know, let's say I'm writing a novel, like, only a few of the days when I'm writing a novel do I sit down and think, man, that felt great, you know? Most of the days it's like, it's kind of a trudge, you know, but then I go back and read those pages later and I can't tell which pages I thought were bad originally versus what pages I thought were great, because it all sort of like, and sometimes you write pages that you think are great and you go back and look at those later and they aren't as good as you thought they were. So you can't tell. Just keep writing. That's the point. Write it, you know, writing a novel sounds very daunting to a lot of people. They're like, holy moly, you write an entire book, you know? But if you think about it, if you wrote, you know, 100 words a day, that would be...
Ain't much.
That would be, let's say you write 200 words a day, which isn't very much. That's a page. In a year, you'd have a novel, you know? So if you write twice that, in 6 months, you have a novel. And if you write four times that, which is still not that much, about, you know, if you write 1,000 words a day, you can write a novel in about 3 months, you know? So that's a first draft. You just plow through. And if something doesn't feel right, just keep going. You know, you can always go back and fix it later. So,
yeah, you'll have a finished product in 3 years after all of your friends hate you because they had to read it.
Right. You know, what's interesting about what you just said, Baker, is I like that idea of, you know, just write. And I know this is, I'm talking about poetry for a second here, but we had poet laureate emeritus from Virginia, Tim Siebels, in April. And one of the things he did in a workshop with us, a student asked, you know, what do you do when you have a block, writer's block? And these are mainly poetry students, but he said, just write similes and metaphors.
Yeah.
And eventually you'll stumble upon something that you'll say, I can take it somewhere. Some days it won't happen, but you just keep writing these similes and metaphors.
Sure.
Until you stumble on something that you go with. And I don't know. I mean, I've written fiction in the past. I did a creative writing minor and all that kind of stuff. But you're absolutely right. Sometimes you just get stuck, you know, and you just have to plow through. And I really like the way you put that. I think that's an excellent way to to be a mentor is to say those kinds of things. That's great.
Yeah.
And this has been a University of Phoenix, how to write.
Yeah, yeah.
The simile and metaphor exercise is really good because so much of writing is just that, you know, like if you have weak similes and metaphors, then the piece will just sort of fall apart. But it's those unexpected ones where you're like, you know, where you have a feeling inside you and it's compared to something that you never would have compared it to or thought to compare it to, but it feels somehow right. And that feels true. And that makes us feel known, you know, by someone that we've never met, you know, but that's what writing is. And in fact, an entire book can almost be like functions like that, like a simile or metaphor where it's like, I've never lived that life, but that person, that protagonist experienced the same emotions as I did. And maybe we can think, I would have done the same thing as that character did, or maybe not. But sometimes, you know, I write crime novels, but, you know, for example, one of my favorite crime novels is The Talented Mr. Ripley by Patricia Highsmith, who was a Texan.
And a complete shut-in.
She was a complete shut-in and one of the angriest, grumpiest people ever, but I love
her.
And, Tom Ripley in that novel, is a murderer. But he's this really lonely guy who just really wants a good life. And he sees another guy who has a good life and he's like, I'll kill that guy and pretend to be him. I don't think any of us would do that.
Speak for yourself.
But as you read that book, you go, you know, I can kind of see, you know, and then you're rooting, and then you find yourself rooting for Ripley and there's four, I think she wrote four of those books, but in each one, you know, he finds himself in these new situations that he has to murder himself out of. And that's why I love crime fiction, because it ends up putting you in the minds of people that you could never imagine yourself sort of. I think I just, advocated murder.
You know, I was going to just add, there was a piece of flash fiction I heard you read at one of the Story Brewers, I think it was. I forget what is the title of it. Forgive me for, but it was about the piece of jewelry.
Oh, the tie pin.
The tie pin. That story was just so amazing. Just, what was it, 1,000 words?
Yeah,
tops?
Flash fiction is 1,000 words or less. Yeah.
Yeah, and it was, I mean, It was crime. It was in its way. It was a crime.
Yeah.
But you wrote it so darn well.
Thank you.
I was really just I was pulled into this 1,000 word piece, and I entered this completely different world from what I was used to being in, and I think that's the kind of thing you're getting at is that in a way, you know, working with these the literary devices and so on and so forth, you can get yourself into places where you wouldn't be before.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, so you advocated murder on the radio, yes, but you also were talking about getting into a world other than the world you're really in.
Right,
You know, and you, with that story, it was just amazing how pulled in on that.
And I think that, you know, we have so many good flash fiction writers here in the Panhandle, and that is a really good way to get into writing. 1,000 words or less. Like, you can write that easily in one sitting. You could write 30 of those in a month pretty easily.
And it's all the rage right now. I mean,
it's very popular. Yeah. So there are a ton of outlets online and print outlets that you can submit these to and likely get published. But you can also think of it as, you know, a novel is 70,000 words. So that's 70 flash pieces. So you write 70 flash pieces about the same characters, you know, with some forward progression, and that's a novel. There's so many ways to think about this where it feels less daunting. And the reason I keep advocating writing novels is because that's where careers are. That's where money is. I do think I write short fiction and I love short fiction. Tomorrow night I'll be reading some of my short fiction. But ultimately, I think the novel for the past 2.5-3 centuries has been the gold standard of this art form. And, you know, which is nothing against George Saunders, you know. But, you know, I think ultimately a lot of people who are writing, they may not be thinking like, they may be thinking someday I wish I could write a novel, but I don't know how to get there. So that's why I keep coming back to that.
That's kind of the cliche in every writer's mind. I'm going to write a novel one day.
Right.
It is. You know?
It's a cliche because cliches come from someplace that's true.
Right.
You know?
Exactly. So, yeah. Absolutely.
Kind of like how, instead of flash fiction, I just prefer to take a snapshot because it's worth 1,000 words.
Oh, my God.
Oh, gosh. Boy.
Did you want to read something? You don't have to.
I could. Yeah, I could.
Do you want to?
I published a little book that just for this reading that I'm just going to be selling at the Burrowing Owl bookstore. It's $10. Of Wild Places, it's called, and it's three stories of crime in the city. I didn't know I was going to be reading, so, oh, God. I'm trying to find something that is appropriate for the radio.
Well, while you do that, I'm going to just remind people we are speaking with Eric Meljack of the High Plains Poetry Project and WT's Department of English, Philosophy, and Modern Languages, and Jonathan Baker, a novelist, a writer, a news curator at HPPR, an all-around great guy, a High Plains hero. He's reading tomorrow night, Burrowing Owl Books, Canyon, Texas, 419 16th Street, 7 p.m. sharp, and I'm just giving you a hot tip. Get there around 6:30 if you want to have a seat, because it gets pretty packed. These are really great reading series, and I really hope that this literary trend keeps going up, up, up all across the High Plains. Also, just a reminder, High Plains Public Radio does have the Radio Readers Book Club, and we've got links to that on hppr.org as well as on Facebook, a way to get in with a literary community as well. There's so many folks all across the High Plains that listen to the station that just love, losing themselves in books, losing themselves in stories, and it's something we really celebrate here on the High Plains. So Burrowing Owl Books tomorrow night. Get there around 6:30. Reading is at 7 sharp. Jonathan Baker, did you find something?
I did. So this is the first story in this book, and it's called The Jaguar, and it's about a Dominican girl who is born in the far northern tip of Manhattan in a neighborhood called Inwood, and for whatever reason, she's just struck by lightning in the sense that she's born a mathematical genius. She is so much more vastly intelligent than anyone around her in any room she's in. She's, exponentially smarter than everyone. And it's torture, especially because she's a Latina woman and she's seen as an object of, as a sexual object by all the men around her. And so the story's really about that tension between what's going on in her mind and her, sort of day-to-day life as a sexual object. Her father, by the way, who's shot at the very beginning of the story, but he was a jazz musician. And so she is sitting, she ends up at Columbia University in the mathematics department, and she meets this Jewish boy, and he's kind of her boyfriend, but he doesn't understand her. He's a mathematician too, but he's nowhere near as intelligent as she is. And they're sitting in a bar on 52nd Street in Manhattan, and Charlie Parker is playing on the jukebox. Weekends, we escape to the little Irish pub on 52nd Street and hide upstairs, away from the tourists, watching through the window Nebraskans and Oklahomans lumber past in their matching T-shirts after being ejected from some West Side Story revival, holy fools debouching into a debauched land. The city does not flow through these people, and they definitely don't flow through the city. Lumps floating on the surface of an energy field. Idiotas. The metropolis won't serve you if you don't understand its mechanisms. I'm Johannes Kepler, pioneering the laws of planetary motion, and you're the rabble, el estúpido mundo. Jacob, my good Jewish boy, slides his hand up my thigh, and I turn my face away from the window. In the pub, Parker is playing ornithology, and I think of the birds of Manhattan, swooping over the city, above the swarm. I've watched them roost on the uptown cathedrals, the red-tailed hawks of St. John the Divine, the peregrine falcons of Riverside Church. The peregrine, the perfect bird for Manhattan, peregrinations, travels on foot, peregrine, alien. High above the towers that loom over 52nd, the moon is shiny and full, and bird is chirping. Jacob is speaking, but I can't hear him. Jazz is my secret refuge. Bird played on this street 50 years ago. It was a different city then, yet the same. This city was here before it was here. Syncopation, the dancing of Bird's thoughts within the steady beat. Parker understood the city. His notes are like footsteps skipping among the blocks of the island, like when I cut through the lobby of Le Parker Meridian to get from 57th to 56th, sneak through the Chrysler building to grab the 7 train, weave through the waddling tourists of Times Square. Bird's horn bends the note and levels. Ornithology was written over the chord progression of How High the Moon. Bird knew how to adapt, musically, not in life. He played in the taxi dance joints in Times Square, a dollar a dance, could play any request from the American Songbook in a single minute. Music, the dream of the masses, and Bird boiled it down to its essence, the fantasies of the continent bubbling out of his horn. Bird, Bird. You never hear me, Jacob says. Sorry, I was listening to the music.
I got to bring $10 tomorrow.
Folks, this is High Plains Morning. That was Jonathan Baker reading an excerpt from one of his pieces that's going to be in an exclusive little, what do you call this, a little chat book?
It's called a pocketbook.
It's called a pocketbook.
It's called a pocketbook of dreams.
Folks, this is going to be a really cool event. So please come out if you're in the Texas Panhandle. Come to Canyon. Check out the Burrowing Owl Bookstore. It's going to be at 7 p.m. tomorrow night. And more information, you can give Dallas a call at 806-282-9888. This is an event. All the details also are on hppr.org. Guess what I'm going to play next?
What are you going to play?
Take a guess.
I hope it's more sitar music.
That's not right. It's ornithology.
Oh, excellent.
Well, Eric and Baker, thank you so much for coming into the studio. Thanks for all you do to really just like celebrate the arts we have on the High Plains. I think this is one of the longest non-guitar-toting interviews we've had on High Plains Morning.
Thank you, Jenny.
Congratulations.
Thanks, Jenny.
All right, folks, here's Charlie Parker on High Plains Morning.